Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. Remember to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. Now, here's our pastor and teacher, Jim McLarty.
Just before I left the house tonight, there was a notice put up on the GCA Facebook page, and it was a very encouraging note, because the note said something very similar to what Gladys said to me when I got here tonight. So I've apparently hit some kind of a nerve. The note on Facebook said, "Thank you, Pastor Jim, for connecting the prophets to the book of 2 Kings, because people seem to think that you read the Bible chronologically, Genesis to Revelation, and you are pointing out that actually there's a fabric that works through it, and you have to understand where things fit historically." And he said, "You're making the Bible," how did he put it? "You're making the Bible logical, or making it make sense," something along those lines. And then I got here, and Gladys said, "What you've done for me is that you've shown me that the Bible is all one big whole book written by one author, and it all fits together and it all makes sense." And this is all really encouraging to me, because it would be real easy to get lost in the weeds. That was the phrase I used last week. It'd be real easy to get lost in the details of 1 and 2 Kings. And so I've been trying very hard to demonstrate why it's necessary to understand these Old Testament books, and to show that these Old Testament books and this Old Testament history resonates all the way into the New Testament. Not only because it resonates with the prophets themselves, so that we can understand the structure and the flow and the historic chronology of the Old Testament, but the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament, is actually the whole of the scriptures that Paul had when he was writing and was constantly referring to the scriptures. So many churches these days concentrate on the New Testament because they say, well, that's where you find Jesus. So we'll hang out in the New Testament. That's about the church. But the New Testament is based in the Old Testament. And if you don't understand the Old Testament, you're not going to understand the New Testament in its length and breadth and width and height. You're just going to know little bits of the New Testament, because you're not going to understand the historic background to the New Testament. And hopefully, if I keep you here late but not terribly late, hopefully we'll be able to see some of that tonight. That's the plan. Thank you for your patience so far with this study, because I know that sometimes it can almost be laborious. It's tough work getting through all these names and places and people, especially when you only get a paragraph about somebody and then they're gone, and the writer tells you, if you want to know more, go look up the Chronicles of the Kings, which we don't even have anymore. And you say, why do these people matter? Why does this matter? Well, tonight I'm going to thread a whole bunch of things together that I think are going to help us understand why these details count. Because remember, Jeremiah, who I believe is the author of 1 and 2 Kings, chose these particular stories about these particular kings in succession because these are the particular aspects of their lives that he wanted to emphasize. And of course, you've noticed the consistent emphasis on the fact that the kings, for the most part, are just no darn good. The kings of Israel are just a succession of bad kings. The kings in the south are occasionally good, mostly bad, and you see Israel continuing in their apostasy and their chasing after other gods. And that's really become thematic in 1 and 2 Kings, and that's why Jeremiah is emphasizing it, because he wants you to understand what's about to happen. Remember that when Jeremiah was prophesying, this was during the time of the Babylonian captivity. So he is living in the outcome of all this stuff he's writing about historically. He's living in the results of all this stuff he's writing about previously. So as he's going through the Chronicles of the Kings, as he's looking back through the history, as he's pulling out these particular stories, these particular elements, and listing them for us in this book of the Kings that we're reading, he's doing it on purpose in order to show us why it is that Israel ends up in the circumstances they end up in. Why the Assyrian captivity? Why the Babylonian captivity? Why the Medo-Persians? Why Greece? Why Rome? Why any of that? Well, he's demonstrating the why that because he's living in the reality, the outcome of all that, and has written for Israel's sake, for Israel's edification, the story of how they got there. And that's really what 1 and 2 Kings is about. And so tonight we're going to tie together some threads, and then we might even get lucky and go spend a few minutes with one of the minor prophets. By the way, I made the joke last week that minor because it's a flat third. It's called a minor prophet. I realized when going back and hearing the recording that I never told you why minor prophet. The only difference between the major prophets and the minor prophets is the size of the book. That's really the only difference. And so the shorter prophets were all compiled into a book called the prophets. In the original Hebrew Bible, there were 12 of the minor prophets gathered together in the book of the prophets, starting with Hosea and working from there. But then in the scroll of what was called the scripture, you had whole books that were dedicated to Isaiah or Ezekiel or Jeremiah, because these were large books. So they're known as major prophets versus minor. See the difference now? It's not just the flat third, no matter how much Tom enjoyed that. And he did.
I have no words for that either.
Here it comes. This is a major chord.
I don't know the name.
That's a major chord.
Well, I don't know the name.
That's okay.
No.
Listen. Now I'm going to make that chord minor.
Oh, sad.
Oh, it got sad, didn't it?
Yeah.
Wait, it's going to get happy. Oh, I'm happy again. And, oh, I feel bad again. Okay, that's a major chord. That's a minor chord. And the only difference is the third note in the triad goes down a half step. By the way, for you parents out there, the first musical interval that children learn to sing is a minor third. Na, 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 na. That's a minor third, you know. Wah, wah. That's why it has that negative kind of sound to it. It's a minor third. Okay, music theory lesson is over for the evening. What were we talking about? So let's tie a bunch of pieces together. Last week we finished off actually in the book of 2 Chronicles. So go there because the book of 2 Chronicles is going to give us the framework that we need to continue in 2 Kings chapter 14. Tonight I want to go through chapter 14 of 2 Kings and the first part of chapter 15, and that is going to be a perfect jumping off place into the minor prophets, and then we are going to spend the next several months in the minor prophets, and then we will return to 2 Kings right in the middle of chapter 15. That's the master plan. We are in 2 Chronicles 25. Go back, though, for a moment to 2 Chronicles 24. Let me show you one other thing. One of the reasons that God was so upset and frustrated with Israel and Judah was because down in Judah, there was the repairing of the temple under Joash. You might remember that. We talked about it a couple weeks ago, how they raised money, Joash's chest. And then the priests kept the money. And so they took the money up in a chest and they gave it directly to the workers. Remember all that? Well, toward the end of that, Jehoiada, who was the priest, died. Verse 15 of 2 Chronicles 24. This is information that you didn't get in 2 Kings. Now, when Jehoiada reached a ripe old age, he died. How many of you think you're at a ripe old age? This is what the Bible defines as a ripe old age. He was 130 years old at his death. 130. You got lots of time.
That's beyond ripe.
That's beyond ripe. 130 when he died, they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done well in Israel and to God and his house. But after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king, young Joash, instead of following after the prophets and after the word of God, when the officials came and bowed down, the king listened to them. That's the beginning of the downfall of young Joash. And they, verse 18, abandoned the house of the Lord after all the work they were putting into it. They abandoned the God of their fathers, and they served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their guilt. Look at verse 19. Yet God sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord. And though the prophets testified against Judah and Israel, they would not listen. So I mentioned last week that this is that time period where God takes the approach of sending prophets, several of them at the same time. As I told you last week, Amos, Micah, Hosea, Jonah are all contemporaries. God is sending them prophets, warning them to be careful because God is about to really bring down the punishment. And we're told right here that they would not listen. So now go forward to chapter 25. When we left off last week, Amaziah had just had a great victory against the Edomites. But then we find out that on his way back, he brought some of the gods, some of the foreign gods of the Edomites back with him. So God sends a prophet to stop him, talk to him, warn him. Starting in verse 14, it came about after Amaziah came from slaughtering the Edomites that he brought the gods of the sons of Seir, and he set them up as his gods. He bowed down before them and he burned incense to them. Then the anger of the Lord burned against Amaziah, and he sent him a prophet who said to him, "Why have you sought the gods of the people who have not delivered their own people from your hand?" He's asking him a logical question. He says, if it is the God of Israel, if it is Yahweh who gave you this victory over the Edomites, why in the world would you worship the Edomite gods that weren't strong enough to deliver them from your hand? Why would you go worship any sort of lesser god when that god couldn't help them? So why are you chasing after that god? It's a very, very good question. Verse 16, and it came about that as he was talking with him, the king said to him, "Have we appointed you as a royal counselor?" Like, when did you get in my court? "Have we appointed you as a royal counselor? Stop. Why should you be struck down? Why should I kill you?" Which is the next thing I'm going to do if you don't shut up. "Why should you be struck down?" Then the prophet stopped and said, "I know that God has planned to destroy you because you have done this and have not listened to my counsel." Okay, just like all of Israel, God sends them prophets. They don't listen. They don't listen to the counsel of God. Well, of course, then Amaziah is defeated in a war between him and Israel. So now you've got Israel fighting Israel. The northern tribes fight the southern tribes. We're going to read about that in 2 Kings, but I want you to see one important thing. Look at verse 19. We'll read 19 and 20. This is after Joash, the king of Israel, has defeated Amaziah, the king of Judah. Amaziah, the king of Judah, has just had a tremendous victory against the Edomites. And so he's all puffed up. He's feeling good about himself. And so he decides to challenge Israel, the northern kingdom. So the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom are going to fight. Verse 19 says, "Behold, you have defeated Edom." This is the king of Israel talking. "And your heart has become proud in boasting, but stay at home. For why should you provoke trouble that you, even you, should fall, and Judah with you?" But Amaziah would not listen because it was from God that he might deliver them into the hands of Joash because they sought after the gods of Edom. Now you've got the declarative statement that the reason that Amaziah won't listen is because God is out to get him. So even when he's going to go to war against Israel, he's going to fall and he's going to be defeated. But the king of Israel says, "Don't do this. I will wipe you out. Why would you do this? But the writer tells us Amaziah didn't listen because it was from God, because God was already going to go get him. Exactly what the prophet said, I know that God has planned to destroy you because you've done this. And once you're on God's target list, once God has decided he's going to destroy you, then you're just going to get stupid. And your ears are going to get blocked and you're not going to listen to reason. And that's exactly what happens to this king. Okay, that's all background. That's all introduction. We're now in 2 Kings. I'm really trying to move tonight because I got a bunch of interesting stuff to show you. Chapter 14 of 2 Kings. Turn there. Chapter 14 of 2 Kings. The first part of this will sound a bit familiar because we read it last week, at the end of the week, out of 2 Chronicles. In the second year of Joash, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, became king. And he was 25 years old when he became king. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jehoadine of Jerusalem. He did the right thing in the sight of the Lord, yet not like David his father. He did according to all that Joash his father had done. Only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now, it came about, as soon as the kingdom was firmly in his hand, that he killed his servants who had slain his father, the king. But the sons of the slayers he had not put to death, according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, as the Lord commanded, saying, the fathers shall not be put to death for the sons, nor the sons be put to death for the fathers, but each shall be put to death for his own sin. All of that we covered last week. New material at verse 7. He killed of Edom in the Valley of Salt 10,000 and took Selah by war, and he named it Jokthiel to this very day. Jokthiel means subdued by God. Then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, son of Jehu, or Jehu, king of Israel, saying, come and let us face each other. Now, I'm going to add one little thing. This guy, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, is one of a succession of sons of Jehu, because remember that Jehu has a promise, because Jehu did good. Jehu was a pretty good king. And because he did good, particularly in that he slaughtered all the house of Ahab, God promised him that his sons would sit on the throne for 4 generations. And so this is one of those 4 sons. We're going to see the end of the 4 sons tonight. Jehoahaz, verse 9, king of Israel, sent to Amaziah, king of Judah, saying, the thorn bush which was in Lebanon sent to the cedar which was in Lebanon, saying, okay, what does that mean? This is really cryptic. You can go online and you can read a whole bunch of commentaries about this. And the only thing they all agree on is that the cedar is clearly the king himself speaking of himself in the first person. The king of Israel, I'm the cedar in Lebanon.
Cedar's in Lebanon.
Yes. And then he says, and I'm being challenged by a thorn bush. But then this next phrase is interesting. This is what he said, give your daughter to my son in marriage. That sounds like a positive thing, but it's not, as you can tell by the next phrase. But there passed by a wild beast that was in Lebanon and trampled the thorn bush. So the best commentaries that I've read on it, because I did go searching, I wanted to really understand this phrase that he said, give your daughter to my son in marriage. The idea there would have been a pact. It would have been peace. And so the king of Israel seems to be saying, there could have been peace here. But instead, you're challenging me to war. You're challenging me face to face. And if that's the case, then I'm going to come on you like a beast in Lebanon. And I'm going to trample you. I'm going to destroy you. You have indeed defeated Edom, and your heart has become proud. Enjoy your glory and stay at home, for why should you provoke trouble so that you, even you, should fall and Judah with you? But Amaziah would not listen. Remember what we read over in 2 Chronicles? He didn't listen because God was out to get him. So Jehoash, king of Israel, went up, and he and Amaziah, the king of Judah, faced each other at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And Judah was defeated by Israel, and they fled, each to his own tent. Then Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, the king of Judah, the son of Jehoash, the son of Ahaziah, at Beth Shemesh, and came to Jerusalem and tore down the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate, 400 cubits long. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures or images of Judah, but it sits up on a hill, and there's almost like a cliff face behind it, and so the front is all surrounded by an enormous wall. That's how they're protected, is that they're up high so they can see you coming, and they have these big, thick walls. Well, he came and just tore down a whole section of the wall, which left the city indefensible. And so verse 14, he took all the gold and the silver and all the utensils that were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house, and he took hostages also, and then he returned to Samaria. Now, the rest of the acts of Jehoash, which he did, and his might, and how he fought with Amaziah, the king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Jehoash slept with his fathers. He was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel, and Jeroboam, his son, became king in his place. This king Jeroboam is known as Jeroboam II in history books, to distinguish him from the first king of Israel, whose name was also Jeroboam. That first Jeroboam was the one who caused Israel to apostatize and to chase after foreign gods so that they wouldn't go back to Judah, where the house of the Lord was, and join in the worship there, because if that happened, they'd all become one people group again. But now that Jeroboam had become a king, he wanted to make sure that his people stayed with him. In Bethel and in Dan, he set up golden calves. And he encouraged worship on the mountains and in the ashram and stuff. So Jeroboam becomes like the template for bad kings in Israel. And every king afterward is compared to Jeroboam. And now we've got this Jeroboam II, so I don't want you to be confused by him. But Jeroboam II, during his reign, is the exact time that Hosea comes on the scene. So this is the period in history. So then verse 17. And Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Jehoash, son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel. Now the rest of the acts of Amaziah, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And they conspired against him in Jerusalem, and so he fled to Lachish. But they sent after him to Lachish, and they killed him there. And then they brought him on horses and they buried him at Jerusalem with his fathers in the city of David. And all the people of Judah took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and made him king in the place of his father Amaziah. And he built Elath and he restored it to Jerusalem after the king slept with his fathers. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. That's the first king, the first Jeroboam in the north, with which he had made Israel to sin. Now look at verse 25. This is just an interesting moment. He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke through his servant, Jonah, the son of Amittai. Somebody look up Jonah 1:1, because this is the only other place in the Old Testament where Jonah is mentioned. And we don't have this particular word from Jonah anywhere in the record. You can look throughout the Bible and you won't find the particular statement from Jonah about the rebuilding of the wall anywhere in the Old Testament. But it's right here, and the reason that's important is it gives you a timestamp. Now you know when Jonah was alive. You know when the whole great fish belly thing happened. It was right here during the time of Jeroboam II. And as I mentioned to you, Hosea happens during the time of Jeroboam II. So now you're starting to get a feel for where these guys show up. And as I mentioned to you before, Micah and Amos are right around the same time. A couple of them to the north, a couple of them to the south. Who's got Jonah 1:1? You got it?
Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for evil has come up before me."
So at the very same time that this is all going on in Israel and in Judah, God raises up Jonah and sends him to Nineveh, which is a foreign king, the king of the Assyrians, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and goes and warns him so that they will stay alive. They do end up repenting. They do remain a power because God is going to end up using them to punish Israel, the northern tribes. But they're getting so bad that God would have to judge or wipe them out. So he sends them a prophet. And interestingly, Jonah, who is identified as the son of Amittai in Jonah 1:1, is identified here in 2 Kings 14:25 as being Jonah, the son of Amittai. So you know it's the same guy. And God sends prophets to Israel, and they won't listen. But he sends a prophet to Nineveh, and they repent in sackcloth and ashes. And they retain their power in the Middle East, and then God uses them to punish Israel by taking Israel out of the land into the Assyrian captivity. All I'm saying from all that is, our God is sovereign, completely in charge, raising up nations, taking down nations, raising up kings, breaking kings' hearts. The heart of the king is in the hands of the Lord. He turns it like the rivers of water, wherever he wants to turn it. God is in charge of all this. But now do you see where the story of Jonah that you've grown up knowing like a Sunday school story, now do you see where it fits historically and why it fits? Why did God send Jonah to Nineveh? Doesn't it seem odd? Why send a prophet to a foreign capital? Well, because he has to keep them going in order to use them as the battle axe in his hands with which he is going to punish his people Israel. Because he's in charge. The same way that he's going to raise up Nebuchadnezzar to punish the southern kingdom. The same way that he's going to raise up the Medo-Persian Empire. And he's going to call out the Persian king by name, Cyrus. And he's going to use Cyrus, though Cyrus never knows him. He's going to use Cyrus in order to bring the southern kingdom back. To rebuild the walls and the streets and the temple again. God is in control of all the kings of the earth, of all the nations, and he's doing exactly what he intends to do. But notice why he's interacting with all these foreign kings and Gentile nations and kings. All of it he's doing because of Israel. Because of a promise he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All the kingdoms of the earth all serve the same central purpose, which is God saving his people, particularly Israel and Judah, but then his elect out of every nation, kindred, tribe, and tongue. Our God's in charge. That's all I'm saying. I get the same theology of God's sovereignty out of the Old Testament as I do out of anything Paul wrote. People like to ignore the first chapter of the book of Ephesians because it's just too sovereign to them, just too sovereign for them. I don't care, one of those sentences is right. It's just too sovereign for them. They just can't handle it. But look at the Old Testament. Every bit is sovereign. Okay, we got to go. We got to go. He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet who was of Gath-Hepher. For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, which was very bitter, for there was neither bond nor free, nor was there any helper for Israel. And the Lord did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. You're going to find out that this Jeroboam, not very good, but God still ends up using him to keep Israel going, to keep Israel alive. Why? Because God did not ever say he would wipe them out or blot them off the earth. Now, there are other people groups that we've read about where God said, I'm going to blot out their name. I'm going to blot out their memory. I'm just going to get rid of them completely. But God never said that about Israel. And because he never said it about Israel, he sent them Jeroboam II to keep them going. And that takes us to verse 28. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might and how he fought and how he recovered for Israel Damascus and Hamath, which had belonged to Judah. And are they not all written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Jeroboam slept with his fathers, even with the kings of Israel, and Zechariah, his son, became king in his place. This is not Zechariah the prophet. Zechariah comes later, but this is just a common name. So that takes us to the beginning of chapter 15, and I just want to read the first 16 verses. In the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, son of Amaziah, king of Judah, became king. He was 16 years old when he became king, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jechaliah of Jerusalem. And he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And the Lord struck the king so that he was a leper to the day of his death. And he lived in a separate house while Jotham, the king's son, was over the household, judging the people of the land. Now the rest of the acts of Azariah and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Azariah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Jotham his son became king in his place. In the 38th year of Azariah, the king of Judah, Zechariah, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel in Samaria for 6 months. Only 6 months, because he did evil in the sight of the Lord as his fathers had done. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, with which he made Israel to sin. Then Shallum, the son of Jabesh, conspired against him and struck him before the people and killed him, and he reigned in his place. Now, up until Shallum, the kings have been Jehu's sons, and if you count through them, we've hit four. Just like God said, that because he had done good, God promised him that his sons to the fourth generation would be on the throne, even though they were evil. Even though they were so bad, some only reigned for 6 months, and then they were killed. The rest of the acts of Zechariah, behold, they're written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel, because this was the word of the Lord which he spoke to Jehu, saying, your sons to the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel, and so it was. Shallum, the son of Jabesh, became king in the 39th year of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Do you recognize the name Uzziah? That takes you right over to Isaiah, whose vision of God, when he said, I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell among a people of unclean lips, that all happened in the year that King Uzziah died. That's what Isaiah tells us. I saw God high and lifted up. Okay, that whole thing when God sent Isaiah to the people, when he said, here am I, Lord, send me. And he said, okay, but you're going to go and you're going to talk to them and they're not going to hear. And I'm going to close their ears and close their eyes and you're going to go and testify against them. Okay, that's all happening right in this period of time. So, let's talk for a few minutes about Jehu. Turn to 2 Kings 10 for a moment. Let me remind you of what Jehu did, because this is really interesting. Trust me on this. Stick with me. It's all going to come together in just a moment. You're going to have a collective aha moment in just a moment. You're all going to go, oh, I get this. I see what's happening. All this prattling Jim's been doing for weeks is all going to fall together in one great big aha. So stick with me here. What did Jehu do? Well, to understand what Jehu did, you have to reach back to the worst of the kings in the succession of terrible kings in Israel. That is Ahab and his wife Jezebel. Jezebel and the doctrine of Jezebel is even spoken about in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation. I mean, Jezebel, really, really terrible. Well, who killed Jezebel? Jehu, this Jehu guy. What was the problem with Ahab and Jezebel? The problem was that Ahab wanted a particular vineyard that butted right up against his home, his castle, the king's house. What does that tell you? That tells you where the king's house is. The king's house is in the area of Jezreel because he wants the vineyard that belongs to a guy who is living in Jezreel, who is a Jezreelite. Naboth the Jezreelite. Okay, so this is all taking place in the area of Jezreel. You with me so far? Okay, so then God says specifically that Ahab is going to die and the dogs are going to lick up his blood and that she is going to die in Jezreel in that very place. And then God says that their whole household, all their children, everybody is all going to die. And they have to die in Jezreel. And then you know that Jehu becomes king. And when Jehu rides into Jezreel in his succession and all his chariots and everybody, she looks out a window to see what's happening. He says, "Who's with me? If you're with me, throw her down." They throw her down. The blood splatters on the horses and on the wall. She hits with such impact. And when he says, "Go out and get her body and bury her," because after all, she's the daughter of a king, a foreign king, they go out and all they can find is the palms of her hands and her feet because the dogs have eaten Jezebel, just like God said was going to happen. And then time goes by and finally Jehu becomes king. I'm in 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 30. The Lord said to Jehu, "Because you have done well in executing what is right in my eyes, and you have done to the house of Ahab according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel." Jehu, we find out in verse 31, was then not careful to walk in the law of the Lord. But in verse 32, we read, "In those days, the Lord began to cut off portions of Israel," because Jehu started so well and then successively got worse and worse. Okay, so what was it that Jehu did that God was so impressed with? He executed the entire household of Ahab. And you find out about that at the beginning of chapter 10. Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria. Jehu wrote letters to those that were in Samaria, to the rulers of Jezreel, the elders, to gather all the sons and the children together. When all the sons of Ahab got together, they all got together in Jezreel. You following me still? Okay, this Jezreel thing becomes really important. Because Ahab and the succession of kings that came from Ahab ruled from Jezreel. So Jezreel becomes emblematic of Israel nationally. And the succession of terrible kings is dragging Israel down and taking them further and further away from the God of Israel. And it's all happening at Jezreel. And then there's all this bloodshed at Jezreel, starting with the fake letter that Jezebel wrote as if it was from her husband Ahab, so that Naboth was killed there in Jezreel. And then Jezebel is killed in Jezreel. And then all the family, the household, in fact, it's a pretty long list. When he comes in, he kills everybody. Verse 11, Jehu killed all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men, and all his acquaintances, and his priests, until he left him without a survivor. That all happened at Jezreel. You got it? Good. That was, in fact, pretty much all introduction to the book of Hosea. So turn there. Go to the book of Hosea.
Naboth, if he hadn't born Naboth, then you'd all this wouldn't happen.
If Naboth had just said, "Yes, I'll sell it to you." But Naboth was actually right in saying, "No, this is my inheritance. This is what was given to me by God." Remember, God assigned territories? Yeah. Now, as I mentioned to you before, this is the first book of the 12 prophets in the Hebrew Bible. This is the second half of the 8th century BC. So that puts it into the 700s. We're about 700 years before Jesus here. I mentioned to you that he's a contemporary of Isaiah and Micah, who are in Judah, but he's up in the north, he's in Israel, and really he is the last prophet that God raises up in Israel before the Assyrian captivity. And so he is crying out to national Israel that God is about to judge them. And here's how the story goes. You're probably familiar with the beginning of it. The word of the Lord came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah. Okay, the very next thing we're about to read in 1 Kings, chapter 15 starts with, "In the 27th year of Jeroboam, the king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, king of Judah, became king. Azariah is Uzziah. So we're right there. We're right in that time frame. The word of the Lord, which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah. Whenever we get back to 2 Kings now, those are the next kings in a row that you're going to see in Judah. Verse 2, when the Lord first spoke through Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take to yourself a wife. Oh, well, this is probably good news. Oh, good, I'm going to get a wife. Oh, good. I've been alone a while. This isn't a bad deal. I'm going to get a wife. Good. Go take for yourself a wife of harlotry. What? Wait. Go marry a prostitute? What? What? I'm circumventing some of this for sake of the kids in the room. But go marry a woman who's an unclean woman and have children. And notice the word children of harlotry. For the land commits flagrant idolatry in forsaking Yahweh. Think about that for just a moment. This is how God views chasing after any other god than him, especially after a rule like you will have no other gods before me. There is nothing more painful, nothing more difficult for a man than the realization that his wife has been untrue to him. There's just nothing more devastating to a man. There's nothing more difficult for a man to deal with than the realization that his wife is not only untrue to him, but that she's been out harlotrying. I was going to pick a much harsher word, but I didn't. That she'd been out sleeping around for money. What does that do to a marriage? I mean, just destroy any trust between the two of you. And God chose that relationship to say, that's what Israel has done to me. I have been a husband to Israel. I chose Israel. I took Israel to myself. And she has become to me an unfaithful, prostituting woman. Think about that. That's how God views any kind of worship that is not the worship of Yahweh. I mean, he takes it really, really seriously. This is not something that he takes lightly. It's not just another option. It's not just another pathway to God. Any worship that is not the worship of God is seen in God's eyes as unclean, sexual, outside of marriage, adultery. Yes. Go take yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry. Now, I'll tell you right now, they're going to have three kids together. But the implication is that only the first one is his. Because she returns to her harlotries and keeps coming back pregnant. The land commits flagrant harlotry in forsaking the Lord. So he went and he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim. She conceived and she bore him a son. Look at verse 4. And the Lord said to him, name him Jezreel. Now, if you just open the Bible at random and began reading the book of Hosea, you're not going to understand that verse at all. That name Jezreel isn't going to mean anything to you. But now, after the weeks and months that we have invested in 2 Kings and understanding the succession of kings from the end of 1 Kings when Ahab comes around, and now that you understand Ahab and Jezebel and the things they did and how Jezreel plays into this whole scenario and the amount of blood that is shed at Jezreel that has now made the whole land of Israel unclean. Now you understand why God would say, name your first child Jezreel. Why? For yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel. Of Jehu? Wait, what? You're going to punish the house of Jehu for Jezreel. Now, when Jehu slaughtered everybody, God said, this is what I wanted done. That was my heart. You did what I wanted done. But in so doing, there was bloodshed in Israel. You might remember that when David wanted to build a house for God, when he wanted to build the temple, that God said to him through his prophet, said to him, you're not going to build it, but your son's going to build it because you're a man of war. You're a bloody man. So you can't do it. Okay, so Jehu did what God wanted done, but now there's all this blood that's been shed in Jezreel, and so God has to cleanse the land. So the first name that he's going to give to this child is going to be Jezreel. Name him Jezreel for yet a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu. What else was Jehu told? That you're going to have four successive sons, and the fourth one was the worst of them, Zechariah. He reigns 6 months and he's killed. And then a different household entirely rises to the throne. At the same time that's happening, God is talking through Hosea to Israel and saying, I'm about to punish the house of Jehu. You see what's going on here? Again, you can start at Hosea and have no idea what's going on. But this is why it's so worth investing the time in Old Testament study, so that when you get to these prophets, you can go, I know where this fits. I see what God is doing here. For I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel. And I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. Okay, the house of Israel is the northern tribes. Ever since they were separated from the southern tribes, they became known nationally, collectively, as the house of Israel. And God is going to put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. Now, remember what we read a little earlier out of 2 Chronicles. God said that he was not going to blot them out. He's not going to blot them off the earth. He's not going to erase their name, but he's going to get rid of the kingdom. He's going to take them into captivity so that they no longer have a succession of kings. But he's not going to blot them out. You getting all this? And it will come about on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. In other words, when the time comes for them to lose their power completely, that's where the war is going to take place, in Jezreel. And as you said, Gladys, had Naboth just said, yeah, okay, you can have it, none of this would happen. And yet it all fell out exactly the way sovereign God intended for it to fall out. Then she conceived again, says verse 6, and she gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion. It's the word mercy. Ruhamah is the word, your King James will probably say no mercy, right? It's the word for compassion or mercy, with the negative on the front, lo. So it's no mercy. So name your first daughter no mercy. Okay. Remember, this is all about Jezreel. This is all about Israel. This is all about them chasing after their foreign gods and God viewing it as a form of prostitution. So he's going to use these children's names in order to demonstrate his relationship with national Israel. Name her Lo-Ruhamah. For I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel that I should forgive them. He's now going to finally hold them guilty. All these years they've been continuing as a kingdom. All these years through these succession of bad kings. All these years worshiping two golden calves. All these years on the high mountains worshiping the Baals or worshiping the Queen of Heaven in the Asherim. All these years God's been patient. And finally God says, that's enough. Now I'm going to punish you. No mercy. Verse 7, but I will have compassion on the house of Judah. Meanwhile, he is, as I already mentioned, sent a couple of prophets down to Judah. And remember, big picture stuff again. He can take Israel out of their land and take them into the Assyrian captivity, from which, by the way, they have never returned. To this day, they have never returned. But hold on. But Judah has to continue until the Messiah comes. Has to continue as a kingdom. After all, David has the promise that his son is going to sit on his throne and rule over Israel. There are all these promises concerning Judah, but all the way back at Jacob, who had his name changed to Israel, who then had 12 sons, as he was dying in Egypt, once Joseph had brought everybody to Egypt, as he was dying, he actually prophesies, speaks words over his 12 sons. And when he gets to Judah, he says specifically that the lawgiver is going to come from Judah. Shiloh is going to come out of Judah, and a lawgiver from between his feet. And so since we know for sure that Jesus is coming from Judah, Judah has to remain intact, even though they're every bit as guilty as national Israel. So national Israel, real guilty, God says, no mercy. But I will have mercy on Judah. Why? Because I've already made a promise and a prophecy that the Messiah is going to come through Judah. Now look at how he talks about Judah. I'll have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by the bow or the sword or the battle or horses or horsemen. He's going to deliver Judah by his own might, by his own power. And by the way, it is through Judah that the ultimate deliverer is coming. He's going to deliver Judah through the Lion of the tribe of Judah. So when she had weaned, no mercy, she conceived and gave birth to a son. Now, as I mentioned, the indication is that these two are children of whoredoms. These are not children by her husband. They're called children of harlotry, back here in verse 2. And when she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said, name him Lo Ami. Okay, Ami is people. My people. These are my people. With that I on the end that shows ownership, like Eli, Eli, my God, my God. Okay, these are people my people. With Lo on the front. No mercy, not my people. Because of Jezreel. Oh, man. So name him, not my people. So can you imagine him going out and saying, Jezreel, come on, come on in. Where's your sister? No mercy, come on, dinner's ready. Where's your brother? Not my people, get in here. Not my people, come on in here. These people had to live with these names. What's your name? Not my people. My sister, no mercy. These are not people you want to hang out with. Yes?
Jezreel's name means...
It's the name of the Valley of Jezreel, the place where the bloodshed was.
It says God sows.
But, yeah, it means God sows.
No mercy, not my people.
But, according to the text, the purpose of calling him Jezreel was because of the bloodshed in Jezreel. It's creating the setting for the name. So, Lo Ami, for you are not my people. Look at the second half of that verse. And I am not your God. You don't want me to be your God? Okay, fine, have it your way. You don't want me? I don't want you either. Yet, look at verse 10, yet. Yet the number of the sons of Israel, remember the promise? I'm not going to blot you out. I'm not going to get rid of you completely. In fact, I'm going to grow you. Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. If that sounds familiar, when Abraham was told how many children he was going to have, God said, go out and count the stars. If you can count them, that's how many children you're going to have. Go and count the sands of the sea. If you can count that, that's how many offspring you're going to have. Okay, well, this is a continuation of that promise. Israel is going to be innumerable. And it will come about that in the place where it is said to them, you're not my people? Okay, what is that place? What God is doing with Israel nationally is that he's going to take them into the Assyrian captivity. And then there's going to be a period where they're going to scatter. And they are referred to as the scattered of Israel from then on. Jesus walks on the planet and says that he is sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Very important nomenclature, house of Israel. This is all about the house of Israel. And Jesus says that he is sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. In fact, the first time that he sends his disciples out, he says, don't go into the way of the Gentiles, don't go into the way of the Samaritans, go first to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and preach that the kingdom is near. Okay, what does that mean? Well, that can only mean the Israelites who are scattered around. Because once the Assyrian captivity ends, they discover that there are people already occupying that land that used to belong to them. Some Israelites came back and intermingled with them, became half-breeds who were known as Samaritans, which is why the Jews hated the Samaritans, because those are the half-breed Israelites. But then most of them are scattered. And there are all these promises that God is one day going to find them, draw them, bring them back to their land. So in the place where they are called, not my people, wherever that is, they could be scattered anywhere to the four winds. But in that place, someday God is going to say, I remember you, you're my people. In the place where they are called, not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. And the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be together, and they will appoint for themselves one leader. Who do you think that's going to be? Well, the rest of the prophecies show us that's Christ, the son of David, who's going to sit on the throne of Israel, ruling over Israel. And so the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together. They will appoint for themselves one leader, and they will go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. And that might be the place where the Lord's sowing takes on some real meaning. But the land, Jezreel, remember I told you Jezreel becomes emblematic of Israel nationally? The day is coming when God is going to take those people who he has cast off, that people group who he has scattered but grew, and the promise. How many times have you heard me say this? How many times? I've said it so often that it should be tattooed to your memory. I keep saying all the prophets of Israel speak with one voice. And they all say that God is going to collect, gather Israel, bring them back to their land, Israel and Judah. Mentioned it last week. What's the prophecy of Ezekiel? After the Valley of Dry Bones, once they've come up out of their graves, God interprets it and says, this is the whole house of Israel. They say, we're cut off. Our bones are dry. We're scattered. But God says, I'm going to raise them up out of their graves. I'm going to bring them back to their land. Very next thing that Ezekiel has to do is take two sticks and write on one Ephraim and write on one Judah and put them together in his hands and walk around telling people God is going to remove the enmity that is between Judah and Israel and going to bring them back together again. Here you've got Hosea saying, the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together and they will appoint for themselves one leader and they will go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. I am proving to you that statement that I keep making is true, that all the prophets of Israel speak with one voice and they all promise Israel a glorious future. Turn to Romans 9. We will pick up in Hosea next week. In Romans 9, Paul is writing about national Israel. Romans 9, verse 1, he sets the frame so that you know what he's talking about. I am telling the truth in Christ. I am not lying. My conscience bearing me witness in the Holy Spirit that I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart. For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen after the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption as sons and the glory and the covenants and the giving of the law and the temple service, and the promises, whose are the fathers, and from whom is the Christ according to the flesh, who is over all, God blessed forever. That's the frame. He's talking about national Israel. He's saying, what I long for most in national Israel is their salvation. But they have these promises. They have a particular promise. Look at 25, verse 25. As he says also in Hosea, I will call those who were not my people, my people, and her who was not beloved, beloved. And it shall be that in the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, there they shall be called the sons of the living God. What did Paul just do? Paul, though he's living in a time when he sees that Israel is still scattered, picks up the promise of Hosea, brings it into the new covenant, because it's based on the Abrahamic covenant, which is unchanging, and quotes Hosea to say, but Israel still has a future. which is why he's still praying for their salvation, which is why he's even saying, I wish I could be accursed so that I could save them. He recognizes the fulfillment of God. In fact, just so you understand who he's talking about, verse 27, and Isaiah cries out concerning Israel. The context is all about Israel. Isaiah says, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that will be saved. For the Lord will execute his word upon the earth thoroughly and quickly. And just as Isaiah foretold, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left to us a posterity, we would have become as Sodom and would have resembled Gomorrah. Why is God doing this? Because he has said, I'm not going to blot you out. I'm going to punish you. So what are we going to say then? Verse 30, that the Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness attained righteousness, even the righteousness that is by faith. But Israel, pursuing a law of righteousness, did not arrive at that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as though it were by works. And so they stumbled over the stumbling stone. Just as it is written, behold, I lay in Zion, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. So what's the solution for Israel's problem? The solution for Israel's problem is the same as the solution for your problem. It's Christ. Yeah, and that's what Paul says. Paul's expectation is that God is going to reassemble Israel. He's going to keep all his promises. After all, he even quotes the promise, in the place where they're called, not my people. They're going to be called my people. They're going to be the sons of the living God. That has to happen. But how is it going to happen? They're guilty before God. How's it going to happen? Well, he goes on to develop the theology in Romans 9, 10, and 11 to say the same grace that saved you is the grace that's going to save Israel. The same way that you were guilty and it was Christ's kindness, grace, and sovereignty that pulled you to him, that same grace and kindness and sovereignty is going to pull Israel. Because after all, you don't have any promises like Israel has. You don't have hundreds and hundreds of years of prophets saying that God is definitely going to come get you, and he came and got you. But Israel has all these promises, prophet after prophet after prophet, saying the same thing over and over again, that God is going to reassemble Israel, call them out from the places where they are. You're going to see it. It's coming up in Matthew. We're going to have to discuss all these things because the eschatology of Matthew, by the time you get to 24, again, is going to have this emphasis on Israel. And God is going to gather Israel and bring them back to the land that he has promised them. Paul cites it in the New Covenant. Hosea saw it just as it was about to happen. Later prophets are going to prophesy like Ezekiel. They're going to prophet during the time that it is happening, like Daniel. And Daniel's going to get a prophecy from an angel. 70 weeks are determined on your people and your city, Jerusalem. God just couldn't be more specific in the way that he over and over again keeps saying, I'm not done with Israel. I'm still working with Israel. I'm still dealing with Israel. But right now is this time that Paul refers to as the times of the Gentiles. But then he says in chapter 11 of Romans, but after the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, then all Israel will be saved. And then he defines who he means by all Israel and says, as touching the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. Well, it's exactly what's going on with Israel right now. As touching the gospel, they're enemies for the sake of the Gentiles. But then he says this wonderful thing, but as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sakes, for Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, for those promises that are the basis for the existence of Israel in the first place. And because God is true to his word and God doesn't change, for that reason, Israel is one day going to be regathered and their kingdom established. Get it?
Yes.
Okay, that was a lot in one night. But does this help you see how the fabric of the Bible works?
Yes.
Because that's my goal.
That's what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was.
That's what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was.
He had been wondering what would happen on the earth after he was gone.
Yeah.
And the dream gave him a whole history of it.
That so ends in the establishment of a kingdom that is never going to be conquered. A stone from heaven comes down, crushes all those kingdoms, the rock of offense, crushes all those kingdoms and establishes a kingdom that is never going to be destroyed. So I keep saying, the prophets are all saying the same thing. And that's part of why we're going to look at some of these prophets. It's because they're all saying the same thing, And the moment in which they're saying it is the moment that we're looking at in 2 Kings. When we return to 2 Kings, sometime between now and when Jesus comes back, whenever we get back to 2 Kings, what we're going to see is the continual downfall of Israel, and the end of 2 Kings is the Assyrian captivity. So you're going to see the fulfillment of what these prophets are prophesying. But what you'll notice is that they all say, but that's not the end. They all say, that's going to happen. God's going to judge them. But God's not done with them. And that's what the New Testament says, and that's what Paul says, and I just don't know why there's any discussion, argument, or debate about that. The only reason that anybody could say that God is done with Israel is because they're just not paying attention to what the Bible says. I didn't hear you, Gladys.
They haven't read all those things.
They haven't read all those things.
They get lost in those names.
Right. That's what I said. The last 2 weeks I've used this phrase, lost in the weeds.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by it.
That's just history of Israel.
Right. That's just history of Israel. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't matter. And it's real easy to get lost somewhere in the middle of 2 Kings. When I was young Lutheran boy, you know, it was read the Bible. And you know, once you get into the begatting stuff, you're like, let me skip forward here. You know, I was fine with Noah and the boat and the good stories in Genesis.
They go from the king of Israel to the king of
Judah. And how do you keep track? And I don't even know who these people are. And I don't. Most people in most churches don't know what the northern and southern kingdoms are or why it matters. But then if you don't get that, if you don't get the first, second king stuff, then you can't get the prophets. You can't understand them. And so now the whole Old Testament becomes a closed book to you. And so then you're going to read what we just read from Romans 9, and you're going to say, what is Paul talking about? So that's why we're doing what we're doing. All I'm trying to do is show the fabric of the Bible and how it all works together. And if that's true, then these 66 books by these various authors over the course of 1,000 years is all written by one author. So now let me just put this important principle in front of you and then we can go. Is the Old Testament and the promises of Israel and the succession of kings and the covenants and all that stuff, is that about us? No, it's not. It's about Israel. Is it for us?
Yes.
Paul says it's good for our edification. Instruction in righteousness is a wonderful way to learn about God. We can read about the law. But are we under the law? No. And that's a really important principle to hold on to, because there are portions of the Bible that are about things other than the church. But they're written for the good and the edification of the church. Got that? The Old Testament was written for the good and the edification and the history of Israel. But then Paul would say that those things are also beneficial for us to read and study, even though they're not technically about us.
So tell us about the world we were born into and the history of the people.
Now we know where we fit, though. That's the point. If you get that, if you get the panorama of Bible history, then you know where we fit. And if you know where we as the church fit, I got to stop. I got to shut up. But once you know where we as the church fit in the panorama of God's history, you don't get all raised up thinking that the church is the pinnacle of God's plan. Well, he got to me and ta-da, we're done here. No, he's still working. He's still doing.
He just kicked those Israelites aside.
Yeah, well, he blinded them on purpose so that the Gentiles by grace would be brought in to make Israel jealous. And so ultimately, he's going to bring Israel back into, because after all, it all belongs to them. Okay, that's that. I shudder to ask, are there any questions? No, forget it. I don't want to know questions. Keep them to yourself. Email me later.
God would love the Israelites that much.
Isn't that hard to believe that God would love the Israelites that much?
No,
I'm still talking, and it's your fault.
I know it.
But why did he love them that much? Because he chose to, and he said he would, and he made them a promise. So why does he love you? Because he wants to, and he made you a promise. And he knows you need him. Okay, so last question. Does that all make sense?
Yes.
I dug through big, big chunks of the Bible tonight in the hope of making sense. We'll slow down next week. We're going to be in the book of Hosea for a little while because it's a fascinating book, but now we know where it fits. Okay?
Yes.
I guess we're done here. Say goodbye to the internet congregation.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. We welcome your feedback and encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.